This is the Goalkeeper Roundtable, hosted by Dr. Bill Steffen, with co-hosts Jeff Shook, Dave LaTourette, and George Costellis. Welcome back to the Goalkeeper Roundtable. In episode 12, we welcome the one and only John Murphy to the table. While he is currently the successful head men's soccer coach at Georgia Southern University, he serves up an unbelievably diverse resume that spans most all levels of collegiate soccer in the United States, multiple experiences in Major League Soccer, and international experience in his favorite country, Scotland. We have known Murph for a long time, and we are proud to have this friend, colleague, mentor, and legend visit with us. And we think you'll appreciate him as well. That said, let's get stuck into the table with Dr. Bill, GK, Shooky, Lotto, and Murph.
All right. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Welcome to Goalkeeper Roundtable. Today, our guest is a well-known acquaintance to all of us here, John Murphy, head men's coach at Georgia Southern University. And he joins us from Statesboro, Georgia. Correct, John?
That's right.
Good deal. Good deal. Well, welcome, man. We're just going to get chatting. So I think, do you know everybody? Everybody get a chance to say hello to Murph.
Murph, good to meet you.
All right, man. How are you?
Good. Good.
Murph, good. It's been a while, my friend, but I'm glad you haven't dropped the Boston accent. So did you get a car with Smart Park yet?
Not yet. Not yet.
Murph, great catching up again, brother. Looking forward to speaking to you.
Absolutely.
All right, well, let's start in just kind of like discussing some ideas here. Murph, with your background, obviously you've got a strong international background as well as a strong domestic background in coaching. But let's start off, let's tell us some of your exploits internationally. I know Scotland was a good experience for you, so you can start there. You can give us anything else, but just go ahead and fill us in on some of your background internationally.
Yeah, my mother's from Glasgow, so I always had that connection. We used to go over when I was a young kid, and probably my first soccer memory was the 1978 World Cup, being in Scotland while Scotland was in the tournament, and remembering that, and obviously with the U.S. Not being a team that qualified until 1990, it was a strange phenomenon for me at the time, being a young kid. But I eventually went over and started doing my coaching education over there, did my coaching badges in Scotland, and developed some great relationships over there. And when things kind of petered out a little bit for me in MLS, as you guys know, as former pros, you just move on to something else. And you know, Scotland happened to present itself, so had a chance to work over there. I was at Falkirk for a little bit with a friend of mine, John Hughes, and then eventually got to Livingston and worked with Paul Hegarty, and eventually, you know, did some head coaching there as well for a couple of months. So it was very volatile, but obviously, just a country where soccer is the number one sport. It was really a fantastic experience.
Good, good. What do we got? Who's got a question for Murph?
Hey, Murph, just while we're on, and I know we probably have a lot of stuff that we'd love to talk to you about, because it's been a while since we've chatted or caught up or anything, but we have discussions on the on our roundtable about sort of development and trends in goalkeeping now. Back in the day, as Billy likes to say it, but from just internationally, your experience in Scotland, talk a little bit about the thought press on the value of goalkeeping, the development of goalkeeping, or any of your thoughts on sort of the youth developmental process there. And you can compare it to what you see in the U.S. right now.
Yeah, it's funny because obviously we have this connection with Soccer Plus and with Tony, and you know, I always found it really really a positive thing when I heard people from real football countries talk about goalkeeping and talking about things like they felt were innovative. And I'm saying to myself, geez, you know, Tony DiCicco was talking about this in the late 80s, early 90s, and people like yourself and the people that we had on that staff, Kim Wyant, just great soccer people and obviously great goalkeeper specialists. So that's how I look at it, where I think sometimes as Americans, we feel like we're second best in some ways when it comes to soccer and certainly with goalkeeping, we shouldn't because of the people, the pioneers that we had in this country, obviously Tony, Joe Matchnick, you know, Danny Gaspar, people like that. So we really are, in regards to goalkeeping, as good as anybody in the world, as far as I'm concerned. And in Scotland, I always found it funny when I was working in Livingston. I mean, you basically had the goalkeepers for 15 minutes and they were straight into working with the team. And you could say, you know, maybe that's not enough time of specialty work, but I don't think they broke it down then the way perhaps we were doing it in America. They want to get their goalkeepers into game situations as quickly as possible. And I guess there's something to be said for that. But, you know, the athletic and the technical piece that needs to be addressed and certainly the front part of a training session from a goalkeeper's perspective is very, very important. And I always felt like as Americans, we spent more time and did a better job with that than perhaps they were doing at the level that I was working at in Scotland. And obviously it was Scottish First Division when you start going up and down division, sometimes the training sessions will vary a little bit, but I always did find that I think we embraced as Americans, I think we embraced the technical and the physical side of goalkeeping at a level that's as good or better than most countries. And I think that's the reason why you see it both on the women's and the men's side. We produce so many good goalkeepers. So that's how I look at it. I never felt second best. Being an American overseas, certainly working with goalkeepers, because I felt like my background with people like yourselves and our soccer plus family, you know, I felt like I had a great background before going overseas.
Good. Yeah, I think one of the things additionally that happened here that I hope continues to happen, I worry a little bit about early specialization, but we developed the athlete, then the player, as opposed to trying to develop a player, then the athlete. I think we have it in the right order by using the gifts we have in America in terms of participation in other sports helps the goalkeeper in terms of all-around athleticism and being able to then apply that more specifically to goalkeeping. Yeah. As you look around, Murph, as you see younger kids now, are there any things that you think, obviously a lot has changed in terms of, you know, obviously the amount of play with the feet that goes on is a tremendous change from, you know, our day. But are there other things that you see in youth goalkeeping now that you think are strengths, and then are some things that you think are weaknesses? In other words, if you were to talk to youth goalkeeper coaches, what would you tell them? What would you tell them they're doing good? What would you tell them that they need to work on? Youth
goalkeeper. Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like the change. I think it was 92 when the pass back rule was implemented. I certainly think that's been to the benefit of not only goalkeepers, but our game. It's definitely improved things, made things a lot more fluid, has brought the goalkeeper into the game a little bit more, a little bit less of a specialist, a little bit more of a team player. So in that regard, I do feel like that's an improvement from, you know, the work that we did, you know, I mean, I go as far back as the mid 80s, and obviously there's people that go further back than that. But I do think we lose a little something with the modern game, and perhaps how goalkeeping is presented. You know, I felt like the pressure training type work that we would do at the, you know, really to highlight a soccer plus camp. You know, there's a huge value in that type of work, and you can certainly modify it. And you, as a sports scientist, you know, understand, you know, better than most of us in regards to intensity and duration. I think those factors can be manipulated. I think sometimes we're getting away from that type of work, and it's a little bit more showboaty type stuff, or work that doesn't really address, as you said earlier, the physical side of goalkeeping. At the end of the day, I think it was Graham Souness, said something about, you know, you can talk about tactics all you want. Soccer's about getting to the ball first, and you can almost amend that to goalkeepers as well. It's about getting to the ball, and I think we lose that a little bit with goalkeeping today, where, like I said, maybe a little bit too showboaty, a little bit too, you know, perhaps soft in its presentation. I still believe that you need to do that type of work, that pressure training type work. And it doesn't necessarily have to be stopwatch, try and replicate an action for 60 seconds. But certainly you can do work to overload the goalkeeper. He or she must have the ability, obviously, to cover the goal, you know, 8 foot by 8 yard, the 6 yard box, 18 yard box, that type of thing. So there are measurements that we can use as goalkeeper coaches that we're constantly setting into our training sessions. They have to be able to cover these areas. They have to be able to get to the ball, that type of thing. So I think we had that in spades and certainly in the 80s. And, you know, you might know a little bit better than me. I don't know if that comes from maybe German-type goalkeeping or maybe Franz Hoek's impact in the United States, you know, through Joe Matchnick. But, you know, that real physical, dynamic goalkeeping training in the 80s, I don't know. I just feel like we've kind of gotten away from it. You know, we were kind of criticized, you know, when I was growing up, if you saved a lot with your feet. Now they're really trying to implement that as a real technique. And you see top goalkeepers save a lot with their feet. I think sometimes you lose a little bit of your ability to come out and smother balls, your ability to come out in one-on-ones and really put the pressure back onto the attacker, if you know what I mean. So I look at those different things. I think there's definitely strengths to modern goalkeeping. There's things that are better than when we were playing. But like I said, I think maybe we've gotten away from maybe some real toughness or some real, I guess, demands from a goalkeeper, from a physical and obviously a mental perspective that needs to carry into a game if you're going to be a top goalkeeper.
I think that one of the things with it, you know, you mentioned about, you know, the pressure training exercise, and in all reality, no, you're changing the fuel substrates and all the other physiological things that go on that aren't really applicable to goalkeeping, but the mental strength that you gain from going through that, I think that's what's missing, as you alluded to. George, I know you got a question, man. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, John, I just wanted to touch on, because I know when we've had a couple of other guests and they were looking at some of the, I'd say, the challenges that to play at the next level. G. Guerrieri, you know, identified crosses. He knew that, you know, his goalkeepers in that time, he really wants them to develop having that presence and the ability to intercept the ball. You know, Tracy Noonan mentioned it as well, that more than likely at the youth level, they're not seeing a number of balls being whipped into the box. I'm just wondering, you know, from your perspective at Georgia Southern and what you've seen recently, what have you identified?
Well, I think a cross ball is always going to be an issue in our game. If you're looking at it from a goalkeeper's perspective, you know, I think as now I've transitioned from being a goalkeeper specialist to head coach, I mean, I want to attack people from wide areas. I think that's what spaces are. I think what G and Tracy are alluding to is right on, where you get the ball into wide areas. If you can get the cross in early, you get the fullbacks or the center backs, the back four turned or back line turned. Now they're facing the goal and you have an issue. I think the greater dimension to crosses now back, you know, is kind of a difference than back when we were playing, is now the ball is really whipped. It's almost like a shot. Whereas when we were playing, sometimes you had that lofted ball. And, you know, for me, it's just an easier ball to pick up. It's an easier trajectory to deal with. Today, I mean, the ball's being whipped in like a shot, and you've almost eliminated the goalkeeper from coming for the ball, and now he or she has to deal with the contact, the header, the shot, the volley, whatever you want to call it. So I think dealing with crosses is always going to be an issue for goalkeepers. You know, I would just kind of build on their thought, which is it's really the decision-making of whether to come or whether to stay. Is really going to be a key for a goalkeeper as they move up levels, because, you know, the ball just getting flung into the box, it's up in the air, there's only one person that can get it. That's a straightforward situation that a top goalkeeper should be able to deal with. But the difficult one is when it's whipped in with pace, you basically put into that space between the back line and the goalkeeper, and he or she can't get there. Are they immature? Are they mentally, you know, weak and they go for the ball anyway and they've just played themselves out? Or do they have the mental strength to be able to to deal with the ball, the second ball, the second contact?
Okay, Murph, you were saying.
Yeah, you know, basically talking about, you know, what goalkeepers, what the challenges are as you move up levels. What I say to field players is your ability to hit and receive balls over distance becomes more and more important as you move up levels, because really, you know, to be able to play out of areas of pressure, you know, an inside of the foot 5-yard pass ain't going to do it. There's times where you have to be able to open your body up, and obviously you're not just putting your foot through the ball and knocking it into the stands, but having the ability to clip a ball and switch play and break pressure is very, very important. Conversely, if you're defending that, then you have to be able to get up, defend, head it, you know, hook it, punch it, whatever. And along the same lines, I guess that was my point about goalkeeping, where you really, you know, it's your ability to deal with that ball, the ball from a wide area. It could be on the floor. It could be clipped to the back post. And it was just kind of piggybacking on what G and what Tracy was saying. They're absolutely right. But it, for me, it's more about the decision-making, the starting position. Even Tony was talking about 3-goal situations. I mean, back in like 1988, you know, so for me, he's way ahead of his time. You know, People talk about these situations now like it's a new thing, which I always kind of find funny, because I always felt Tony was a real innovator. So I have to agree with that. That's really for goalkeeper coaches, youth coaches, you know, setting up functional exercises. So it doesn't necessarily need to be like it is in Scotland, where we were just basically knocking some balls into each other's hands for 15 minutes and then straight into a functional session. But can you build your warm up into eventually a functional session where you're working with your back line, back four, back three, whatever it is, and then dealing with those decision-making situations? So I really do think that's the challenge for the new goalkeeper coach. It's not just knocking balls into the goalkeeper's hands. Can he or she take parts of the team, attacking parts of the team, defending parts of the team, and kind of set that attacking versus defending scenario up where you're dealing with these decisions, I guess?
Yeah, I think your point's valid, Murph, especially in talking about, you know, how deep do I want this line to drop? Because, again, the space you talked about, if I'm the attacker, I'm trying to put it into that space in between the back line and the goalkeeper. And the goalkeeper is trying to do the converse, the opposite, saying, well, okay, if it comes in this, that space, either the backs are going to win it or I'm going to win it. And if we can't, then they're too high, I've got to get them to drop. And if they're too tight, then I can push them up because I can cover that.
Absolutely. And having that presence, that voice, having the confidence. And then again, it goes back to what we're talking about with the physical side of goalkeeping. And it's funny, I have a goalkeeper who I think is very, very good, but he's not the tallest. And I always say it's funny because, like, you look at a goalkeeper who's 6'3", and everybody just assumes they're good at dealing with the ball, and that's not the case at all. But when you are a smaller goalkeeper, you really do have to deal with the ball in the box more, because people hesitate to put the ball in when it's a 6'3 goalkeeper. When it's a goalkeeper who's 5'10 or smaller, that ball's getting delivered every time. So it's about taking something that's a perceived weakness and actually turning it into a strength. So, you know, you have to be able to physically cover those areas. And if you are that much smaller, then you do your footwork, your starting positions, your dynamic movements, your power, and your legs has to be that much better. Just as conversely, when you're a taller goalkeeper, that ability to get down and make those low saves are very, very important.
Yeah, true. I just always remember, now I'm going back because I do go back, but if you guys remember Arnie Mauser, I throw the name of Arnie Mauser.
Sure.
Arnie was like 6'3", 6'5". But he never came for anything. And I would always talk to him after games and say, man, you're so lucky. He goes, they don't cross on me. I'm big.
It's like Chucky.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm the one doing all the work. Yeah. What other kind of questions do we have for Murph?
John, I've got one for you. With your time over in Scotland, if you could possibly address if you ever saw multi-sport athletes, with soccer being the predominant sport there, and if there were multi-sport athletes, what sports were they participating in?
Yeah, I mean, my love for Scotland, I'm probably a bigger Scotland fan than a lot of Scottish people. So I love the country, the culture, the people, even the weather. But I do have to say, I think the indigenous population in Scotland, you know, it's a country of, you know, I think 5 million people. And that's where we're quite fortunate with a country of it's 320 million or more. Our athlete pool is that much greater. So in regards to other sports, I mean, you do have the tennis, you do have the track. You know, there are other sports in that country, rugby obviously being a big one as well. But I think because of the professional sports are so powerful, or the professional clubs, I should say, are so powerful over there, Celtic, Rangers, Hibs, Hearts, they the kids specialize very early over there. So, I mean, if you're a goalkeeper and you're playing for Hibs U10 team, I don't think you're playing really anything else. You may be playing a little tennis on the side, but I don't think you're playing it the same way that perhaps a kid in this country may be playing, you know, AAU basketball, Little League baseball, and then playing some soccer as well. So I've always felt it's a real strength of ours. I do find it funny with some of the things that, you know, we're trying to get more like other countries, and we're trying to eliminate college as an option for kids because you can't develop kids in college. They need to go straight to the pros. And I always find that quite funny because I think there's a lot of countries that would kill for the system that we have here, you know, the ability to go to college, how women are treated with a lot more respect and the same resources, and in some cases better resources than the men in the college game. And it trickles down to the youth game as well. I mean, I think our kids should be playing multiple sports. I think it's never going to hurt them. Eventually you do get to an age, probably 14, 15, 16, there needs to be some specialty decisions in regards to what sport you're going to play. But I think it's one of our strengths as Americans that we do play multiple sports. And while we can't say that these countries don't have other sports, of course they do. It's not just soccer. I think they specialize, the top kids specialize so early that they really do not get into second sports or third sports the way that we do over here.
Good. You know, the DA has folded or altered, changed, whatever, things like that. But kind of on a tangent of what you're saying, as a college coach, what do you think about high school soccer in terms of recruiting a kid? Is high school soccer a benefit or a drawback when you're recruiting a kid?
Yes, I think it's outrageous to say that high school soccer is a poor venue to develop players. I know plenty of high schools that are fantastic venues for kids to develop. And I hate to say it, there's plenty of DAs or ECNLs or whatever you want to call them that are poor areas to develop players. So, you know, to just go straight across the board and say that, you know, one level is better than, or, you know, is excellent, and the other level is not, is not fair. Now, is ECNL, you know, and DA soccer better than high school soccer? Of course it is. It is. It's a better level. It's a better level of soccer. But you can't say playing for your high school is a complete waste of time. I think some of the things about playing in high school can prepare kids very well for college. I mean, I've gone to high school playoff games and there's 3,500 people in the stands. That's a real atmosphere. And that's a real, with something on the line, a state semifinal and playing for your high school and, you know, getting in the bus and, you know, having the pep rally. I mean, I think those are real special things about playing sports in high school that, you know, we shouldn't discount as soccer people. You know, with all due respect, we're not talking about hockey. I mean, like hockey in the Northeast in particular, kids, you know, some kids do not play high school hockey because they're basically playing a level of you know, junior professional hockey. I just don't think we're there yet in this country. If that's where we're moving towards, then okay, so be it. But I still think you're talking about a very small percentage of our national player pool. I don't think kids should be browbeaten for wanting to play in high school. And I think every situation needs to be looked at as an individual thing. It can't just be seen as straight across the board, you shouldn't play in high school. There's plenty of great high school coaches. There's plenty of great high school environments that these kids can grow and learn from. And like I said, all that glitters isn't gold. Sometimes people say, you know, DA is the best and ECNL is the best. You have to look at the club. You have to look at who the director of coaching is, the quality of the staff. I'm a little old-fashioned. I think the kids travel way too much. I think there should be more regionalization within youth soccer in this country. We need to do it more like France. I mean, we had the system in place. We had region 1, 2, 3, and 4. And obviously we did that for ODP and you know, and we've kind of moved away from it. I think we need to get back to that type of work where I think it's crazy that, you know, we get kids piling into buses and doing 5-hour bus rides to play a league game. I just don't think that's really where our focus should be. It should be closer. There should be less travel and more emphasis, you know, really put on developing the player rather than getting caught up in awards and nice gear and flying to different tournaments.
Yeah, I think as it relates to high school, Murph, just one thing, if kids pigeonhole themselves into just their only club, they only get the experiences of a couple of coaches, a single system, and certain players. But if they are open to that opportunity, and here locally it's changed a bit where the kids are playing both club and high school, they get exposed to another coach or another coaching staff, whether that coaching staff or coach is good, better, different, whatever, sometimes a different system, but more than anything, now they're playing with classmates or guys that they wouldn't normally play with. If they're a U17, now they're playing with a 16 or an 18 or whatever, but now it's a different group of dudes, and they have to learn to play with each other, get along with each other, develop relationships. And we all know from coaching collegiately,
can I give you a call
these
back?
Kids all come in from different environments, and they have to be able to manage that.
Cool.
No, there's no question. And with you know, we're getting back to, you know, having the beautiful pitches. I mean, yeah, you go play a high school game and you're playing on a football field that's 65 yards wide, or you're playing on a, you know, the quality of the pitch isn't as good, or, you know, maybe the quality of your teammates isn't as good. So what I tell, you know, like I have a young son who's a freshman in high school, and he's definitely on the lower end of the totem pole, but I mean, he is a half decent player. And I say the same thing to every high school kid. If you're that good, then dominate, be
exactly
a top high school player, dominate. And then that teaches you how to be the best player. It teaches you how to deal with people expecting more from you, and you know, and trying to help a player next to you who's not as good through a game. And you know, the story I've been using for years, and I don't know it firsthand, of course, but you know, Maradona, you can say whatever you want about him publicly, but his teammates loved him. His teammates loved him, and I think the top players have that understanding that they cannot do it by themselves. So a Ronaldo or Messi or whatever. So they're working from the premise that the people around them aren't as good as them. And if you're caught up with that and you can't play with people because they're not good, you're not going anywhere. So I think, you know, I always use Maradona as an example, but I guess you could say it about any top player. The top guys get it. The top guys know that I need this guy. I need this guy to play. And if he goes in, you know, if he goes in the tank because he's psychologically can't handle it, or I'm yelling at them all the time, then you're going to have a hard time. So I think it's good for these kids who are top club kids, go back and play for the high school and then dominate, be the top player, be one of the best guys in the conference. And I think that's a great experience to learn how to lose, learn how to play with guys that aren't that great, learn how to, you know, get a bad call from a referee and he's really not up for maybe the level that you've played out with your club team. But as you know, we all played. I mean, played on bad pitches, bad refs, bad situations, and it makes you a better player for sure.
Well, I think also, Murph, I'm agreeing with what you're saying 100%. It gets that DA player who's playing on a high school team, or that ECNL player who's playing on a high school team. Now you have a lot more responsibility for the outcome.
Yep.
When you're playing with your club team, you know what? Everybody's a good player. Everybody's good. On that high school team, you have a lot more responsibility for the outcome. And giving kids this responsibility benefits them as a person, but also as a player.
No question.
Cool. What else do we have for him? What else do we have for Murph? I'm trying to get my questions here.
Hey Murph, I think a good one would be you have a really, and I really appreciate this because I've had similar, but not as diverse of coaching experiences as you've had, but as a, maybe starting out as a goalkeeping specialist, or that's where we knew you as a goalkeeping specialist, and your evolution into, let's say, MLS, junior college, NCAA Division I, Division II. I think you were at Assumption, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
But talk to us, and maybe us, but to our goalkeeping coaches out there that maybe have aspirations of moving up the ladder, not only maybe of level, but also I'm a goalkeeping specialist, but I want to become an assistant coach and then associate head coach. Yeah. What's your experience or your suggestions there?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, one, like learning from all of you, and I'm not just saying it because I'm on the call with you, but you know, those goalkeeper camps in the late '80s, and you guys know, and Bill was a professional at the time. I mean, it was really a vacuum in between the NESL and MLS, and you know, like you were bringing, you know, top people were there. Paci Bono was there. I work with Peter Benetti and you know, Alan Meyer. I mean, you're working with big time guys, and I always felt like, you know, the people that we're working with, they had a bit of showmanship to them, which I thought was really, like, you were very good at it, Lotto, like really fun and energetic. Joni Shakow was someone I had a ton of respect for. But, you know, these people came to life when they step on the field. And, you know, I remember Billy was doing the pressure training with all the campers, the whole session and everything. And, you know, I think having a little bit of that, you know, it's not only showmanship, but I guess, you know, saying to the kids, hey, I'm doing it too. Whatever I'm asking you to do, you know, I'm going to do it as well. I think you have to have that when you're working at the lower levels. I think when you get to the professional level, and Bill was a pro, I think one of the things that I had going for me as a goalkeeper specialist, I really needed to develop a relationship with those two guys, those two goalkeepers. And if I had a strong relationship with those two goalkeepers and they knew that I cared about them and they knew I put a lot of time into my training and I had something to offer them, they were not only on board, but the field players were on board. So instead of me trying to be buddies with John Harkes, I didn't even talk to John Harkes. I was focusing on, you know, Jürgen Sommer and Jeff Causey. And as long as those guys were okay, then they're going back to Harkes and saying, listen, Murph's good. Murph knows what he's doing. And then my relationship with Harkes instantly improves. So you know that. Yeah, you have to have something to offer. That's what I've always said. I don't think you can move up levels. And I don't think you can sustain any kind of success if you don't have something to offer. So, you know, I try and be humble with the things that I've done. I'm proud of my career, but I will say you can't last, you know, forget about 10 days, 10 months. You can't last in the pros for 10 years if you don't have something to offer. So I think as a goalkeeper specialist, you do have the, it's not a luxury, but you have the advantage of just trying to keep a smaller group of people on side and happy. But at the same time, now you are being scrutinized even more because you're dealing with specific people and specific situations and how you manage those and work with the head coach in regards to who plays, who doesn't play, the rhythm of training, that type of thing. So, I mean, I had some real goalkeeper wars that I was overseeing. Aiden Brown, Jürgen Sommer was a big one. Matt Jordan, John Bush, I'm sure they get along now. When they were competing at Columbus, that was, you know, that's management. That wasn't coaching. That was management. and even like Buna Kandul, you know, trying to knock Joe Cannon off his throne in Colorado. So, I mean, those are the three examples of kind of goalkeeper, not necessarily conflicts, but competitions that I had to be able to deal with. And I think the players at that level appreciate, you know, I'd be the first one to say, listen, I didn't play at your level, but this is what I think. Or I didn't play at this level, but this is what I observed. And so having a little bit of that humility, because this is how these guys take care of their families. This is how these guys pay their mortgage. And my advice, whether you were a top player or not, but certainly if you weren't a top player, you cannot come in and use a command method with top professionals. Jürgen Sommer played in two World Cups. I'm not telling Jürgen Sommer anything. You're doing a lot more guided discovery. You're doing a lot more Q&A. And I think that's where my background with you know, my mother being a teacher, my sister is a teacher now, my wife's a teacher. I mean, I've kind of been in that teacher mentality for a long, long time. And again, going back to Tony and Soccer Plus and the things that we all did together, you know, those teaching methods were broken down. So I have a real understanding of methodology and how to break down, you know, diagnose key faults and how to improve them. And the pros really appreciate that. I think the professionals, They gravitate to the people that really care. So whether that be the equipment manager, the trainer, the team administrator, I think as a coach, you still have to have that spot where they know you care about them as people first. Otherwise, you're not going to get anything out of them. So that would be my advice to anybody. I mean, certainly do your licenses, certainly get your certifications. I'd sacrifice money and time for experience and connections, but you can't BS your way through these situations. I think that's where I'm probably the most proud. You get to a point where you really have to come through. You have to come through for these people and show them that you're capable of helping them improve and get better. And I'm proud when I look back at my career. The challenge is still the same at Georgia Southern. The kids that are coming through now, they're more demanding than kids 20 years ago. So it is like working with young professionals. So the challenges don't change regardless of the level that you're working at.
Murph, I think the biggest thing, you mentioned relationships, and we talk about mentors. And I think we all rely on each other, but we all have had some of the same mentors as well. And there's a small tree that we all fell from, but we rely on those people. And that mentorship is friggin' huge. People ask me, and you mentioned some of yours, and people ask me, and it's really easy for me to say, Tony DiCicco, Sasha Sarovsky, Steve Swanson, Janet Rayfield, and I can, I just go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then I have,
that's pretty good.
Yeah, but then, and it's easy, and it's, but it, those people develop me, and without thinking about it at the time, they help develop me, who I am, what I believe in. Yeah, I made mistakes along the way. We all did. But when we come back to center, and it's great to be able to sit here in this environment with Billy. Jeff is, new to my world, and I really appreciate what Jeff is bringing to the table, figuratively and literally to our table. And a guy like George, where, heck, George and I are probably only like 3 or 4 years apart. But when I was at Hartford, that 3 or 4 years was a bigger difference. And here we are now. We exchange phone calls, emails, text messages all the time. So it's for my point being is for coaches coming up, players that want to become coaches, develop good relationships, find some mentors.
Yeah. And there's a saying that my friend gave me, and he didn't come up with it, but he uses it all the time. Dig your well before you're thirsty. So, the reason why you could call Tony a mentor is because, we did the business for Tony. We got up at 4:30 in the morning to catch a 6 a.m. flight and get and set up a new camp and work for him. And that's why it's very sad that he's not with us anymore, because he would be someone that I would, give a call and pick his brain a little bit, because I really did feel he was quite innovative and really, really bright. Not only about the game, but about life. But yeah, I think those things, you can't just seek out mentors. You really got to do the business. And with, at the risk of sounding like an old man, I do think the young kids nowadays, they want everything now, and they want everything given to them. And, I tell my kids on my team, and I tell my young assistants the same thing. You guys have every right to expect from me what I demand from you. It's not an equal thing. So the coach of being the old guy and saying and doing whatever he wants, those times are gone. But we're not peers. I think that's where young kids need to understand. So if you want to develop a mentor, you really need to come in with a humble attitude and heart, and then those opportunities are going to open up themselves. Otherwise, you're just going to run into brick walls, because in this business, it's about, understanding where you are in the whole scheme of things and showing respect for people that have done it. Like that picture, that's your background. I got a lot of respect for those people. I know a lot of those people, that's all part of it. You have to move up levels. And I think that's the thing I enjoyed about working in the pros. The pros are very, there's a lot more fear in the pro game than people might think. You might think young kids are scared. I think there's a lot of fear in the pro game, and Billy might be able to talk to this. And that's why we need to depend on each other. That's why they gravitate towards people that do care about them. Like I said, equipment managers, trainers, specialty coaches, because there's so much on the line. There's so much to lose. And I think we have to be humble in our approach as we move up levels. And certainly if we're looking to approach someone to be a mentor, you know, you got to dig your well before you're thirsty, man. You got to put some work in, you know, for me to pick up a phone call and make a call for you or write a letter for you or, you know, to help you move on to the next phase of your career. Because that's where I am right now. At my age now, now I'm becoming the mentor and people are approaching me. And that's really my advice that I give to young players and young coaches.
That's great. I appreciate
good,
that.
Good
I
think yeah.
Soccer Plus was a lot like that. You respected the guys that came before you. You know, so it was, and they did the work, so we got stuck in, and I think that's why we all get along.
Well, I remember Tracy Noonan as a 12-year-old camper. I mean, and then, you know, she's winning a World Cup, and I mean, you know what, talk about, you know, the amount of pride I had in that, you know, for her and just knowing her a little bit, you know, was really special. So, yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, she was going to any Soccer Plus clinic or camp that was being run in the New England area that I was at. She was there. Our parents drove her there and look at all the great things that she's gone on to do. So it's absolutely true.
Yeah, I think, Murph, as you were speaking about, you know, the mentorship and that whole role, I think we have to remember a cliche, you know, paying your dues. I think we've all paid our dues. And a lot of kids nowadays don't understand that, or their idea of paying dues is not the same as my idea of paying dues.
No.
The fact that you put in the time and you put in the effort and it was appreciated.
Of course.
Yeah, Murph, I tell you what, I'm going to say, because earlier on you mentioned your college situation now, and I think we probably be negligent, and I know you may not, it's the not most pleasant subject, but how are you dealing with the whole COVID situation in your program? What's some of the hurdles that you have to jump now?
We're dealing with it very, very carefully. We have to be one of probably 20 teams in the country that are playing right now. So there's four Sun Belt teams. I think there's 13. ACC teams, BC's out, so now you're down to 12, that's 16. UAB are playing some games, Mercer are playing some games, but in regards to teams that are actually playing for a conference championship, you have ACC and you have Sun Belt, four men soccer. And SEC is going for women's soccer as well, and I think Big 12 is going as well. So first and foremost, it's exciting that we're still fighting and we're still trying to play. Obviously trying to keep the student athletes' health at the forefront of everything that we're trying to do. But we test every Wednesday, and like I'm sweating out results every Friday and Saturday. And we just got the report back today that we're all negative going into this weekend. So we have one more round of tests next Wednesday before we're at South Carolina a week from tomorrow. So I think we all have to be prepared for a new challenge. I might be getting a tap on the shoulder before we get on the bus next Saturday, and I'm being told that four kids are out, one kid's quarantined, and his three roommates are out. And we're keeping a big roster on purpose. What I told my assistants in March is I do not want to hear about us not having enough players to play. So if our athletic director, if our conference, our university, and our department are going to move forward and play in the fall, then we must be ready. And with all due respect to my kids, my team is no different than any other team around the world. You have top kids at the top of the roster. You have some kids at the bottom of the roster. And then you have a bunch of kids in the middle. And, you know, the NCAA is typically giving us a free year. So we're playing. And if that means that I'm playing Jimmy, who's my third string goalkeeper in goal, Jimmy's playing. That's it. We're not going to cancel. We're not going to fail. We're not good enough. I'm afraid of going to South Carolina and losing 5-0. No, we'll play anybody, anywhere. And it's easy to say that when you have your full selection of players. But I really feel that way. Even if you knock my roster down a little bit, we'll go anywhere to play a game. So we're very fortunate. Our schedule is 10 games, which is more than any other school in the country. I've looked it up. ACC teams are playing 6 games. I think Georgia State's playing 9, and we're playing 10 games this fall. So 10 games from September 19th to basically November 6th, that's a game every weekend with a couple of midweek games. So it's a pretty substantive schedule. We have We have a free year. The kids get their eligibility back. So I think it's pretty exciting. And we're just going to have to ride some bumps out. Obviously, the kids' health and safety is the most important thing. But our SWA, who's our head athletic trainer, she has to be one of the best in the country, Brandy Klaus. And I don't want to accuse anybody of anything. I'm pretty confident we have the most stringent COVID rules in the country. We are enforcing them, and she is trying to keep 10 balls up in the air at the same time with football and all our other sports. And for a team of 32 guys to have all negatives going into the weekend, I'm pretty proud of those kids. It really shows the sacrifice these kids have made. And it's not easy. They're getting up, they're practicing, they're going back to their room, they're really isolated. There's very limited class time for these kids. And it's not ideal. I feel for them. My oldest son's a senior in high school, and obviously we all know people that are going through this right now. It's just a real tough challenge. I get my back up when people call it the new normal. This is not normal. We're going to get through this as a country, as a society, and get out the other side of it. We have to be careful. But it's a real, real challenge right now. But if we can get on the field next week, it'll be a pretty emotional moment for me, because I think that show a lot of sacrifice that my kids have done since, you know, basically March. And if we can get to a situation where we're playing for a conference championship in November, I told the kids, I said, you'd be telling your grandkids about it. It'll be an amazing story. If we can get through those 10 games and get to a semifinal, you know, in Atlanta for our conference tournament, November 13th, we're playing with house money, because if we can get to the final, you're talking about an amazing, real adventure for these kids.
Cool.
Hey, Murph, hey, I'd like you to address, and I gave Billy this question for us, and part of this is personal for me, because I have junior college sophomores that are looking to transfer. Four or five really solid dudes academically, and a couple of them, we definitely have one good Division I prospect. And also, this is relative to high school seniors. So I know we talk goalkeeping here, but this is relative to goalkeeping seniors, goalkeeping sophomores looking to move on to 4 years. Is that now Division II is now in the same situation where they're letting you play up to in your year the total. Basically, you're getting a free year, so you're going to retain some players. How is that affecting you in terms of scholarships, and how would you suggest that those players, junior college sophomores, high school seniors, approach that process, because they may be getting into a sort of a backlog situation that those things aren't maybe not available to them for initially out of the gate.
You're absolutely right, and I think a couple ways I'm handling it. The way I'm handling my kids is, and it's obviously a flawed process, especially when you're dealing with kids out of region or out of the country. It's a flawed recruiting system where a lot of times you're seeing kids play by video. Maybe you see them once live, and then you make a decision. If I make a mistake on a kid, then I've made the mistake, and I'll live with the obligation for the scholarship. But that goes up until the timeline that has been determined, you know, before pre-COVID. So any kid that's going to get an extra year out of me is going to be based on performance. So I've told all my seniors that. So there's a couple of kids that, you know, I got a kid who's all conference and you know, was newcomer of the year his freshman year. He's coming back. Don't worry about that. But there's a couple of kids, you know, I'll be frank. I've had a couple conversations with a couple of kids, and I said, listen, these are the things that you're going to need to be able to do. You know, there's a performance element to it. There's an academic element to it, and obviously a social element to it as well. And if we can get to the fall and end of the season and I feel good about that situation, then we can activate you for one more year in 2021 that we weren't expecting to do, and I'll cover the scholarship. We do not get out in front of our recruiting like some programs do, certainly the women's side. I can see the women's side having an issue, because they really get out there early. I'm very old fashioned. I just think a lot can change in 18 months. So I don't like getting too far out in front of my recruiting. So I think financially I'm okay. But these kids that get that extra year, it is based on performance. So if I've messed up and maybe you weren't the player that we thought you were going to be, you know, I'll deal with it over the 4 years and I'll manage you. I'm not going to take your money from you. You can't be a cut. cutthroat. I think there's an aspect to being a college coach that you really have to, one, get the evaluation right, and two, if you don't, try and manage the situation as best you can, which I'm proud to say we do a good job of. I do a good job of that. But if you want that extra year out of me, then it is pure performance, without a doubt. And so that's there may be kids coming back on a scholarship, and there may be some kids where I say, listen, maybe you need to go to a grad school option and just move on to the next phase of your life. But how that affects your specific kids, you're absolutely right that there is a there may be a logjam. There may be a logjam for these kids coming through, and I don't know how that would affect them. I don't know if the NCAA or NJCAA might give them some clemency for that and maybe extend their timeline. I'm not sure, but you bring up a very good point. I have friends from all over the world calling me saying, listen, I know you need a center midfielder for 2021. And I say, listen, I really don't, because my center midfielder is going to come back for 2021. Right. So you're right. It's a real issue. I don't think it's a slam dunk. I am not just going to bring everybody back for their senior, for the fifth year just because they're nice kids. There has to be a performance element to that. But every coach is a little different. So at the very least, it will create a conflict or make it more difficult for these kids, for sure.
Yeah. Cool. Good. Murph, been great, man. Unless there's other questions, but otherwise we can let you get back to training, which is a nice thing.
No, it's been a crazy day. So just to give you an idea, our football team plays tomorrow, and, I just basically came back. We spent the whole afternoon putting up signage for COVID and trying to get social distancing. And we had 25,000 stadium seats that we were trying to prepare. And that's why I look like I got dragged through a rose bush backwards. So my apologies.
Tricky, don't let him fool you. Murph looks like that every freaking day.
Fair point.
Yeah. Murph, it's been great to catch up. It really is.
No, it's great. I think this is the kind of stuff we need to do. And, with all the negatives of COVID, there has been some really, as coaches, as we always do, we come up with some real innovative ways. And this is exactly what it's all about. I've been on some great Zoom discussions like this, and I know you guys have a great following, and if I'm a goalkeeper coach, I'm listening to this. Even if you pick one thing out of it, it's worth it. So hopefully there was some good information there for people, but I enjoy interacting with peers and talking with people like yourselves, and it reminds me of the good old days, man. We had some fun, for sure.
Yeah, we did.
The good old days were good, man.
Yeah. Well, we just need more pizza and beverages. That would be it.
late night pizza.
All right.
Late night. Well,
really appreciate the time, man. Good luck.
No, thanks, guys.
Good luck with the season.
We hope you enjoyed that episode at the Goalkeeper Roundtable. If you'd like to reach out with suggestions, comments, or questions, all of our email addresses are available in the show description. If you like the show, we'd love for you to subscribe to it, but also share it in social media platforms or with any other goalkeeper or coach who may find value in it. We hope you turn in to the next Goalkeeper Roundtable.